KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. As a child, Amanda Lindhout dreamed about the exotic places she saw in National Geographic. As she grew older, she traveled all over the world. In 2008, she was abducted while reporting in Mogadishu, Somalia. For 15 months, she survived abuse by imagining herself elsewhere. After her release, Lindhout founded the Global Enrichment Foundation, a humanitarian organization dedicated to empowering women in developing countries. Lindhout spoke about her memoir, A House in the Sky, at Town Hall on September 16th. The talk was moderated by her co-author, Sarah Corbett. Lindhout speaks first.
In my 20s, I was a free spirit. I was an adventurer. I grew up in a very poor family, poor by North American standards, living with my mother in a series of basement apartments. And I always dreamed about being out in the world, but traveling wasn't something my family did. We didn't have money for that. So the world to me was the images that I saw on the pages of National Geographic magazine. These magazines that I treasured, that I kept in a stack beside my bed. I got those magazines because my older brother and I, after school, we would trawl our neighborhood and go dumpster diving, as we called it. We would crawl into these garbage dumpsters searching for treasures, and especially looking for empty bottles that we would take into a bottle depot, and we'd get a couple of coins. And then I would take those coins into my favorite used bookstore. And so those images that I saw on those pages of National Geographic magazine that I collected weekly from that bookstore, they were everything that I wanted the world to be. This exotic and beautiful and accessible place. And then as a young woman, after I finished high school and was able to start working for myself and not really sure of what I wanted to do as a career, but knowing that I wanted to be out in the world working a series of jobs as a waitress, was able to cobble together enough money to get myself out into the world, what I discovered was that the world was accessible to me, and that people everywhere have far more in common than they do differences. And it was a six-week trip to Venezuela when I was 19 years old, my first trip internationally, that really cemented for me this love of travel, and then that led me throughout my 20s to travel all over the world, usually alone, usually on a shoestring budget. I should actually say always on a shoestring budget, with a backpack on, going to over 50 countries, that led me to the places that you saw in that video, places like Pakistan and India and Bangladesh.
So from my perspective, I viewed those places with some fear. You know, there's a part of me that, especially at that age, longed to see those parts of the world but was afraid. Did you feel afraid in these places?
When I first started traveling, I wasn't choosing countries like Pakistan to go to. I was choosing the beautiful, sunny places that everybody wants to go. And the more countries that I traveled to, the more borders that I crossed, I learned that it is often the places and the corners of the world that we know so little about, that we're afraid of, which are home to just genuinely kind and hospitable people. And that's what I was discovering to be true about the world. And so the more borders I crossed, the more confidence I gained. And I would talk to people who had dipped their toes into Afghanistan, travelers who would talk about how magical the culture was there and how exquisitely beautiful the mountains were in the north, and how different it was than the picture that we see on TV. And then when I finally dared to try my luck and to go there myself, that is also what I discovered to be, by and large, the truth.
traveling around, what you would do is you would go off for maybe 3 to 6 months at a time, and then you'd go home to your home in Alberta, Canada, and save up enough money to go out again. And you have told me that you know how to stretch a dollar like nobody else. And in the book, we write about one night in the winter of, let me see if I can get this right, 2006. You were in a taxi that pulled up in front of a one-star hotel in Ethiopia, and there was a handsome man sitting on the porch. Can you tell us about that man and that night?
Right. It was definitely a one-star hotel, if it was anything at all. So, yeah, I was 24 years old and having my first adventure in Africa. And Africa was from the time of my childhood, where I'd always wanted to go. So this was a kind of a big trip to me, a big deal. And traveling around Africa on your own with a backpack can be a bit rough. So I arrived at the Barrow Hotel, this shabby 0.5-star hotel, late in the evening. And there was a man sitting on a porch reading a travel book that I really loved. And he was handsome, a handsome bearded Australian man. And I checked in, and then I came out and I sat with him and started the conversation by talking about the book and why he was in Africa. He was there because he was a photographer, and he had been contracted to take some photos of a nonprofit organization that was working in Ethiopia. And that really piqued my interest. This was Nigel Brennan, the Australian man who a couple of years later I would be kidnapped with in Somalia.
What did Nigel had an impact on you personally. You two fell in love. I think I can share that. But he also shaped your professional path a bit. And I'm wondering if you can talk about what you saw, what you learned, or what you saw being with him, and how that changed or didn't change your path.
Yeah, as we write about in the book, Nigel and I spent 3 really fun months together, traveling around Ethiopia and falling in love. And I was really inspired by Nigel. He was doing something that I thought really mattered, which was he was out in the world having adventures like I was, having fun, but he was also sharing the stories of the people that he was meeting and stories of the culture that he was learning about with others through his images. And I thought that was really valuable. And though Nigel and I's relationship fizzled, our friendship remained. And I went back home to Canada, and I bought myself a fancy camera, and I started taking photography lessons because I thought that that was what I wanted to do too, that I wanted to be a journalist. I thought that being a journalist might be the answer to a question I had often asked myself as a young woman about how I could make a difference in the world. And so I thought, finally, I had the answer to that.
And you went on to do what a lot of young freelancers do, especially in an era where we have no shortage of conflict zones in the world, which is you went on to locate yourself in some of those conflict zones, like Kabul, Afghanistan, Baghdad, Iraq. Can you talk about what led you there and what you found in those places? Because now you're no longer backpacking.
Yeah, up until this point, I had been having a great deal of fun and adventure traveling around, but without a lot of purpose. So after taking these photography classes and setting myself back out into the world, this time it was with, you know, a newfound sense of direction. And so I was young and I was ambitious, but I wasn't especially trained or experienced. But I did base myself in places like Kabul, Afghanistan, and then later Baghdad, Iraq, where I started to have some success selling photos, selling, and then later doing television work.
So again, another fateful day, and now we are in the summer of 2008, you reconnected with Nigel Brennan and you made the decision to travel to Somalia. Tell us about that decision.
So at this point, I had been based as a freelance journalist in Baghdad for about 7 months. And I had my eye on the country of Somalia. And Somalia, if you don't know, it's a small country on the Horn of Africa that has been broken apart by over two decades of war, that doesn't have an effective central government. It's a country that's largely controlled by extremist groups. And so a lot of major media outlets have stopped sending reporters to countries like Somalia. It's too risky for them. So there is opportunities for young freelancers like I was to tell really important stories. Somalia is often referred to in the media as the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet. And so I had my eye on that country and the stories that were coming out of there. And I began to plan a trip for what I thought was going to be a one-week work trip into that country. And it happened really right before going into that country that I reconnected with Nigel Brennan, somebody who I hadn't talked to at this point in a couple of years. We had lost touch with each other. And Nigel decided he wanted to join me. And so we met up in Kenya, which is the country that neighbors Somalia, and we made all the preparations for our trip. We got our visas and our plane ticket, and then together that August, we boarded a small plane bound for this one-week work trip.
What was your first impression of Somalia?
I got my first impression a couple of hours after the plane had taken off from Nairobi, and it was out the airplane window. And what I saw was an astonishingly beautiful country. Somalia has the longest coastline in all of Africa. And what I saw were unspoiled white sand beaches as far as the eye could see. And there were no highways or beachfront hotels built up alongside that. It was like unspoiled tropical paradise. But as soon as our plane touched down and we disembarked, I understood immediately that what many of my journalist friends had told me about Somalia was true, that it is a country and a war zone unlike any of the other ones that I had been to.
Amanda Lindhout, the author of A House in the Sky. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
KUOW. Tomorrow afternoon, we're going to talk with playwright Elizabeth Heffron, who may be best known for her play Mitzi's Abortion, the story of a woman carrying a seriously damaged fetus. It won ACT Theatre's New Play Award in 2005. More recently, Elizabeth Heffron was one of five playwrights chosen to participate in Seattle Repertory Theatre's Writers Group. Heffron's newest play is called Bonita, which had its world premiere Wednesday at Seattle Rep. The play is a departure for Heffron. Bonita is a play for one actress. We'll talk with Elizabeth Heffron about Bonita tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from area schools affiliated with the Northwest Association of Independent Schools. More information about open houses, financial aid, and the range of education choices such as Annie Wright Schools is online at nwais.org. Support for KUOW comes from Fair Start. Evening and weekend dates are available now for catering of private holiday parties at their location in downtown Seattle. Off-premise catering services are also available. More at fairstart.org. Fair Start. Great food, better lives.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Amanda Lindhout traveled to Somalia in 2008 as a freelance journalist. She was abducted and held for 15 months, and she writes about the experience in her new memoir, A House in the Sky. Lindhout spoke at Town Hall on September 16th, 2013.
So on the days leading up to August 23rd, our very first days in the country, the danger in Mogadishu was really palpable. You could really feel it in the air. But, you know, as you need to do, you settle into the environment. But there was this current of danger really running through everything that was unnerving and unsettling. And it was our third day in the country. It was August 23rd, 2008. And we had set out to, with the intention of filming an internally displaced people's camp, which was just on the outskirts of Mogadishu. And so all of us were piled into this SUV vehicle that we had rented, and we left the outskirts of the city, and we were rounding a bend in the road, and as I remember, I was daydreaming, I was lost in thoughts, until our vehicle started to slow down. And then I looked up, and I saw out the window that there was a car pulled over off to the side up ahead. And about a dozen young men holding AK-47s with their faces wrapped in checkered scarves emerged from where they had been hiding behind that vehicle. And so our vehicle was forced to slow down and stop. And our doors were pulled open, and the next thing I knew, I found myself lying face down in the dirt, spread eagle, with a gun held to the back of my head.
What goes through a person's mind at a moment like that? What were you thinking?
I think it's really difficult to comprehend a moment like that. I wanted to believe that it was a robbery, or maybe they would let us go when they realized that we were really in the country because we cared genuinely about what was happening inside of Somalia. It was a slow understanding over the next 24 to 48 hours that, in fact, what had happened was we had been kidnapped. And when one of the leaders of this kidnapping operation visited Nigel and I and demanded our family's contact information, and then later my father received a voicemail message demanding $1.5 million for my life, I knew that it wasn't going to be over quickly.
What can you tell us about who these people were who were holding you?
I was kidnapped by a group of teenagers and young men. The youngest one was 14 years old, who were being controlled and manipulated by another group of young men who were their commanders. So the group of mostly teenagers that were holding Nigel and I captive day to day, I sensed didn't really want to be there. This was a job for them, a job in a country where there are no jobs. They were young people, most of whom hadn't been to school, some of whom were orphans. The 14-year-old boy's body was marred by horrific scars from a bomb blast that he had been in. And some of these young men were even friendly to Nigel and I. There was one of our captors named Jamal, who was 18 years old, a tall, skinny thing with a big smile, who really couldn't wait for this whole thing to be over because he was engaged to a young girl named Hamdi, and he just wanted to get out and marry the girl that he loved. And another young man named Yahya, whose wife was pregnant with their first child. And I could sense their frustration and their desperation for being part of this, but there were others in the group too that had clearly been radicalized. Young men who spoke of suicide bombings, who spoke of jihad, who spoke of their hate and anger towards the West.
And how was the kidnapping organized? You're speaking about these leaders. How were the leaders trying to extract the money from your family, or were they trying to get it from your government? What levers were they trying to hit?
So there were the teenage captors who were holding us day to day, and then there was the separate group, the leaders, who dropped into the house occasionally, you know, to check on conditions, to bring supplies. There was their money guy, who we nicknamed Donald Trump, who would come in with money and food for the whole group. And then there was their communications guy, a guy named Adam, who wore round spectacles and pinstriped shirts, and who would call my mother to discuss the ransom and to negotiate the amounts. My mother, who was working as a cashier at a bakery at the time that I was abducted, receiving phone calls from Adam demanding $1.5 million for my life. Some of them spoke English. Some of these leaders had traveled around the world a little bit. Donald Trump liked to come into the room that Nigel and I initially shared and talk about the different qualities of olive oil that, you know, as he had experienced when he was traveling around Europe, you know. So there was a whole mix of the young boys who had no sense of the world outside of their own village, and then some of these leaders who were much more worldly and who were using their knowledge to manipulate those younger boys.
And you mentioned you and Nigel being held in a room together. You were moved several times early on from house to house to house in these unnamed villages that you didn't know where you were. How did you, they're 24 hours in a day. How did you pass the time? What did you know about where you were? Were you hopeful? Were you unhopeful? What were those early months like?
Those early months were really hard. I mean, it was hard, obviously, adjusting to this new reality, having absolutely no freedom. But Nigel and I, we were kept together. We were given food. We were given bottles of clean water. So fighting boredom during those first months was actually one of the biggest challenges. So Nigel and I, we would come up with games to play. Our favorite one being, we had large acetaminophen tablets that our captors had brought us. And Nigel, who had spent some time working in construction and was really good with his hands, was able to carve those acetaminophen tablets into two tiny dice. And we would spend hours playing backgammon. He won, I won. I won most of the time. But really anything to pass the time. But, you know, it was extremely difficult. And for me, I am fortunate to have a really optimistic disposition. I've always had that. And so I can remember that I would start the day, much to Nigel's annoyance most of the time, by saying, today is going to be a good day. And I would end the day by saying, we're one day closer to freedom. And that's how, even from the beginning, I had to think of it.
And I mentioned earlier that when you set off from Mogadishu, you were traveling with three Somali colleagues. Explain, they were kidnapped with you. What did you know about them and their conditions in those first months?
Our three Somali colleagues were kept separate from us, so we had very, very, very little communication with them. But I would glimpse them sometimes, looking very thin, very mistreated, coming in and out of a room that was completely dark. So I knew that these young men were being held in the pitch black. And that was really hard. Nigel and I, we were kept together for those first 3 months. And, you know, that really helped save us. You know, we had each other to rely on. But after 3 months, Nigel and I, we were separated. They came into our room one day with guns, and they packed up Nigel's stuff, and they moved him to another room in the house with no other explanation but to say that if we tried to communicate with each other, they would kill us. And that was it. And we learned how to secretly communicate with each other, Nigel and I, and we get into more detail about this in the book, how we did that, and it's really kind of an amazing story. But we learned how to secretly communicate because we were learning to be resourceful. You need to be when you're a hostage. And we did that for a couple of months, and then at about the 5-month mark, I woke up one morning and the house sounded very quiet. Your senses become really, really sharp when you're in a contained environment like that. And when my captor brought in breakfast to me, I asked him, "Where are the 3 Somalis?" That was the noise that was missing. I couldn't hear them conversing. I couldn't hear them in the house. And he told me that they had been taken out the night before by given to one of the extremist groups, a group called Al-Shabaab, and that they had been beheaded. And so this was a real turning point for Nigel and I, believing that our 3 colleagues had been killed.
So right about this time, Nigel tells you that he has been studying the window in the bathroom that the two of you share. And he thinks maybe you could get out. Describe that.
So with this news, I mean, Nigel and I, we were devastated. And I'll say that I felt some responsibility to one of those 3 Somali men who was my cameraman. I had hired him to be my cameraman, spoke English, and he had 3 kids. And I was so devastated by this. We were really, really feeling desperate, Nigel and I, after believing that our 3 Somali colleagues were killed. And so when Nigel started talking about escape, I mean, I thought it was an impossible idea. I didn't see how we could get out. There was a bathroom that we shared, and there was a window in that bathroom, but it was sealed. There was bricks cemented across the front of the window, and there were iron bars across that. So when Nigel started talking about this, I mean, I thought, well, it'd be great, but I don't see how we could do it. But Nigel had notice things that I wouldn't have because he spent time working construction, like that the house we were being held in, it was old and it was really poorly constructed. And so we decided to try it out with a pair of nail clippers that our kidnappers had given us. We took turns sneaking into this bathroom when our kidnappers weren't watching and crawling up onto this high window ledge and digging at this crumbling mortar with those nail clippers until we were able to remove a couple of those bricks. And we jumped out a hole about the size of a basketball to our freedom.
I think we all have the same question. What happens next?
We hit the ground running, and I knew immediately that it was bad. It didn't look anything like I had imagined it to in my mind. It was this desolate desert scene, and we ran out from this alleyway that we had jumped into, and there were some Somali women wearing, you know, their beautiful, colorful hijab, walking, and as we ran towards them screaming for help, all these people started running away from us because, of course, if we're running from something towards them, they better be running too. And our plan was to go to a mosque. We knew there was a mosque nearby because we could hear the call to prayer, and we thought once inside the mosque, we would find help. So we had timed the escape for the middle of the day when we knew the mosque would be full of Somali men who had just finished their middle of the day prayer. But of course we had made noise when we jumped out the window of the mosque, and so our kidnappers were in hot pursuit with their guns. And when we raced into the mosque, which was full of these Somali village men, our kidnappers chased in behind us, and there really wasn't much that anybody could do to help us at that point.
But there was one person who did do something.
So in the mosque, it was a scene of absolute chaos. More people arriving with guns, and people running and shouting and gunshots going off. And Nigel and I just trying to dodge our captors' hands. They were trying to grab us. We could see that there was a truck waiting outside, waiting to take us away to whatever was going to happen next. And in the middle of this, a Somali woman came into the mosque from the back door. She was the only woman, other than me, in this crowd that was, I don't know, maybe almost 200 Somali village men. And she was wearing the full Islamic dress, including what's called the niqab, which is the full face covering. So all I could see was this woman's eyes. She came through the mosque, through this crowd of gun-toting men, and she came directly over to me, and she embraced me. And in English, she called me her sister. And she began pleading with my kidnappers to let me go. But of course, they didn't have any patience for this, so they grabbed me by my ankles and then began towing me by my ankles, so I'm on my back now, being towed by my ankles across the floor of the mosque towards the door, towards that truck. But this woman didn't give up. This woman, she threw her body on top of mine. And she was dragged partway across the floor of the mosque with me until she couldn't hang on anymore, and then we were separated. And right before they pulled me out the door of the mosque, I looked back and I saw her. She was sprawled out on the floor. Her niqab had been pulled off of her face. And I saw a woman my mom's age, and she had tears pouring down her face, and she still had her hand outstretched to help me, even as three men with guns surrounded her. And then I was pulled out the door, and I was put in the truck and taken away to all of the punishment that followed. And that woman that day, I don't know what happened to her. But she risked everything that day, you know, including her very life, to try to save me. And she's a woman that in Somalia, she's probably got kids and grandchildren of her own. And she touched my life in such a profound way that day. And she really gave me a gift that stayed with me when I needed it the most, for everything that I would face in the 10 months to come. I would think about her, and I would think about her courage that day from such a pure place to help another person who was in need.
Amanda Lindhout, the author of A House in the Sky. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW. 94.9 Seattle.
94.9 KUOW. Tomorrow evening, an examination of the power of mass media to create panic, as in one of the most controversial moments in broadcasting history, the 1938 broadcast of Orson Welles' radio play about Martians invading New Jersey. The War of the Worlds is believed to have fooled more than a million people when it originally aired, and it's continued to fool people since in Santiago, Chile, Buffalo, New York, and with disastrous consequences in Quito, Ecuador. Radiolab tomorrow evening at 7. Lows around 40 tonight, cloudy skies, some fog as well. Friday highs around 50, cloudy skies and fog. Music and conversation with the husband and wife team of Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr., members of the iconic 60s pop group The Fifth Dimension, at 10 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from TherapySearch.net, a place to turn when making the important decision of choosing a counselor, providing information to help those seeking counseling make educated choices and find psychotherapists who meet their needs. On the web at TherapySearch.net. Support for KUOW comes from the Arlington Arts Council, presenting a concert featuring Tayla Lynn, granddaughter of country music singer Loretta Lynn, Saturday, October 26th at the Burns Performing Arts Center. Details at ArlingtonArtsCouncil.net and tickets at BrownPaperTickets.com.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Amanda Lindhout traveled to Somalia in 2008 as a freelance journalist. She was abducted and held for 15 months, and she writes about the experience in her memoir, A House in the Sky. Lindhout spoke at Town Hall on September 16th, 2013. Next, she talks about what happened when she was caught after she tried to escape.
I was locked up in a room that I named to myself the Dark House. It was a room that was pitch black. I wouldn't have been able to see my hand stretched out in front of me. And I couldn't move my body at all because I had a thick metal chain that was wound around my ankles and secured with two heavy padlocks. And I was forbidden to sit up or even to lay in my back. I was permitted only to lie on my side on this thin foam mat on the floor in the dark for 24 hours a day. And I had lost everything, even the things that you think can never be taken away from you. I lost the sun and the sky and the breeze and food and family. I lost my own name. They renamed me Amina, which was a name that I lived with for a long time. And the size of my prison was no longer the room that I was held in as it was before the escape. It was the size of the mat that I was confined to on the floor, so 2 feet by 6 feet. And survival became not about making it through the day, but about making it through the minutes. And I've used many different strategies to get through a day. Games I would play in my mind, but the most effective thing that I could do to pull myself out of the dark places that my mind was going to was to go to my house in the sky, which was a place that was within my own mind and yet somehow outside of myself out here, where I could remember the life that I had lived and all the beauty of the world, where I could think about the life that I wanted to go on to lead if I made it out of there. It was a place where I could think about sitting down with my family and sharing a nice meal. It was all the aspects of my life in some ways that I had taken for granted before, that now I longed for with every part of my being. In my house in the sky, I could access that at any moment. And the other thing that helped me survive was a slow understanding of who my captors really were, which was products of this war-torn environment. They are these young people that are completely shaped by the war and the violence around them. And the more I began to really understand that, it helped me, because it helped me not see them as monsters, though everything they were doing to me was monstrous, but as the perpetuators of violence, but also as the victims of violence themselves. And that understanding helped me get through the minutes when anger and rage and despair threatened to overtake me.
And during some of the very darkest moments, you made a vow to yourself. I'm wondering if you can tell us about that vow.
Yeah, I think, and anybody in this room, I mean, we've all suffered. But I think when you go through a really life-changing event where there is great suffering, it leads you to ask big questions about life. And for me, I thought, if I get a second chance at life, if I make it out of here, I want to be of service somehow in the world. That felt really important to me. And so I started to think about what that looked like and what that meant to me. And so I had now this understanding, this really unique, up close and personal glimpse at the conditions that are creating young people like my captors. And with that knowledge of poverty, of war, of suffering, broadly speaking, in a country like Somalia, I guess you could say I almost felt a sense of responsibility to do something to help in whatever small, humble way I could, if I made it out of there, to create some kind of positive change there. And so I began to think about what that would look like. And I knew that education was really important. I had heard all of my captors talk at different times about education, including one of them, a young boy named Hassam, who really early on in the kidnapping had told me, when none of the other ones were around and could hear him or bug him about it, he said to me in this broken English that I think he learned mostly from listening to the BBC radio, he said to me, "I don't like being a soldier. I want to be a student. I want to learn English." And he later, you know, went on to, you know, to do things that he will have to live with for the rest of his life. But I often wondered how they would have been different if they had had access to opportunity and to education. And so I knew that I would dedicate part of my life to creating positive change in that country if I were to make it out.
And so we're all here, thankfully, seeing you, knowing you made it out. Can you tell us about November 25th, 2009? What was that day like?
So after, I should say, on day number 460, I woke up that morning. We had been moved yet again to another nameless village somewhere, and I was again held in the dark in some sort of a storage shed that had held animals before. I was in there, this filthy, disgusting place, and I was starting once again to really slip into despair. I was always fighting that in my mind. And on day number 460, that afternoon, my captors came into my room and they led me out, and someone produced a little rusty saw and they began sawing at the chains that had been on my legs for 10 months. But I didn't think it was towards freedom I was going. I thought, I was sure, in fact, that they were making good on a threat that they had made over and over and over again, that they were finally selling us to another group, a group that had the funds to keep this thing going on for as long as it took for our families to get this money together. And so I was terrified. And they put Nigel and I into a vehicle. At this point, we didn't even try to communicate with each other. We had both been beaten down to the point we wouldn't even attempt it. And night was falling, and so we drove through the dark out into the desert, and it ended in much the same way that it began, in the middle of a desert, very unexpectedly. We were put into a vehicle with strange men we had never seen before, and I thought these were our new owners. And then someone thrust a phone at me. And I took it, and my mother was on the other end. And she said to me, "Amanda, you're free." And so, yeah. So the next day, I was flown with Nigel to a hospital in Nairobi, where my mom was waiting for me, standing outside the hospital in the sunshine. And that reunion, that first embrace where she held me and she told me over and over and over again, "You made it. You made it, you made it," was the moment I had been dreaming of for so long. For so long that it felt surreal. I had had the most vivid dreams in captivity of freedom. And then when I was given freedom, it was really hard to grasp. It felt like something that I could lose at any moment. And that day began what continues to this day, which is the long and really difficult road of recovery and life on the other side as a, you know, fundamentally changed person.
So you went back to Canada and Nigel went back to Australia and you started healing. And this was about the time I met you, not too long after this. And you were talking about that vow you made to yourself. You mentioned it the very first time I met you. So tell us what happened with that vow.
So when I came home, I was really sick. I was really, really sick when I went back to Canada. I was extremely malnourished. I was really thin. I had to have extensive dental work done. I was not looking my best. And I was talking about my dream and my hope of starting this organization to help people in Somalia. And you can imagine, I mean, people thought it was a really strange response to have given the severity of what I had lived through. And I started to talk about forgiveness. And people thought that was a very strange thing to hear me talk about after everything that I had been through. And I needed to explain the forgiveness piece to them in order for them to understand why I wanted to set up this organization to help the people of Somalia. Because I had had this understanding of who my captors were, and the situation which is unfolding for all of these millions of young people and women across the country of Somalia. That was the inspiration to start the Global Enrichment Foundation. But the missing piece people couldn't understand was, why, after everything I had been through, would I want to do that? Wasn't I angry? Wasn't I full of hate? Didn't I want to bomb that country? You know, people were really upset, especially when they saw how physically injured I was. But I had started a process while I was still a hostage, while I was in the dark house during the very, very worst times of captivity, where every single day I made a choice to forgive them for what they were doing to me. And it was something that I did not for them, not as something to give them. I'm giving them my forgiveness. It was something I did for myself to survive in there. And it really was that understanding that they're the, you know, these young people, products of their environment, that allowed me to cultivate this seed of compassion in me. And it still meant that every time I was abused, I was full of anger and hate. But I really came to believe that they were able to inflict this kind of suffering on me because their suffering was so great. Because anybody that is a healthy, happy, whole person does not have the ability to inflict suffering on another human being. So it's quite a statement about their own state of suffering that they were able to injure me in the ways that they did. And so forgiveness was something I chose over and over and over and over again in captivity, as many times a day as I needed to. And I continued to do that when I came out, and I was talking about starting this organization, the Global Enrichment Foundation, when people expected me to be very angry and full of hate. I just didn't want to engage that. Choosing to forgive and cultivating compassion in myself is part of what saved me in captivity, and it was something I wanted to continue to do, to choose. And so it was about 4 months after I was released that I made good on that vow I made to myself in captivity, and I started the Global Enrichment Foundation, starting first with a program to honor the woman at the mosque, the woman that risked and might have lost her life trying to save me. So working alongside the Canadian Somali community, we established this program called the Somali Women's Scholarship Program. So we had 10 scholarships available, full university scholarships for women in Somalia, women who want to take leadership roles in their community and their country. And one of the requirements was that they write an essay. And they just would describe to us this, the board of directors that I had established for the Global Enrichment Foundation, that they would tell us what kind of change they were going to make in the future of their country.
Amanda Lindhout, the author of A House in the Sky. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Overlake School in Redmond. Rigorous college prep classes and a wide range of arts, athletics, and global service opportunities for grades 5 through 12. Open house for grades 5 and 6, October 30th from 9 to 11:30 a.m. Details at overlake.com.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.